outside and come in with a new way of thinking about the problem to break it. And speaking of which, the third person just has. Welcome back, Arnicos, and welcome back, listeners. You join us for the pub episode, and there's only one pub we could possibly be in for this episode, and that is the Counting House Bar that sits inside Old Lloyd's Bank on Broadstairs High Street to this day. Inside this bar, two escape rooms were once hosted, the bank job and the heist, which my team has just played. So, let's introduce ourselves first. My name is Jonathan David Charles Saunders II. I am drinking a lovely 10-year-old tawny port, which is very delicious. And locked in the bar with me today, we have...
I'm Anikos, and I'm drinking a lovely warm cup of Earl Grey tea with alternative milk and a little bit of honey.
That does sound nice, actually. So, I think it just sounds nice in the voice.
And I'm Aled, and I'm drinking a pina colada Baileys.
Oh, what? Hang on. I'm trying
that
to...
sounds terrible.
Trying to visualize that with my taste buds.
I will get you the bottle. Hang on.
Oh, Lord. I bet this bottle is
also
everything.
Aled, if you are drinking
is,
a pina colada, I'm expecting a pineapple slice. I'm expecting a little umbrella.
You're going to be disappointed.
Yeah, I think... He lives in Milford Haven on the coast. They don't have pineapple.
Milford Haven?
There.
I don't even know where that is. I've never heard of it.
It's like that bit in Wales that is to the rest of Wales what Merthyr is to the English.
Hey now.
And again, not being from this country, I don't know where Merthyr is or what it is to the English.
It's a shithole.
That it is. But
why don't you just say that? Oh, hello.
Oh, good Lord. Okay, so that is quite the bottle. That is a cream Baileys bottle with pineapples all over it.
A Baileys colada.
It's a limited edition Baileys.
I'll bet it is.
That's because no one's going to buy it.
It's actually rather nice.
No.
Oh, it is?
What's the liquor in Baileys again? I always forget. What's the liquor? Because normally pina colada's with rum, but what's a normal Baileys made with?
I don't know what it is.
Irish cream, isn't it? It's just...
Oh, that's whiskey then.
Mm.
It's whiskey with cream, I guess.
Yeah.
And sugars or sweeteners or something.
Yeah. Dear listeners, tell us, what is Baileys? We'd love to know. What is this?
What is a Baileys colada? What's in there? So I'm presuming coconut cream. Pineapple?
They're not going to tell you on the bottle, Aled. Don't look
it's
at that.
It's got to say
They're
something, surely.
It yeah, it does. It says, ever wonder what sunshine tastes like? This fresh twist on a favourite tropical treat blends our irresistible Irish cream with the flavours of creamy coconut and sweet, juicy pineapples. It's summertime bliss in a bottle.
Is it now?
It is rather nice. I'm pleasantly surprised because a colleague of mine brought it back from Ireland for me, and I was like, oh, that's a bit interesting.
Yeah, that I mean, to be honest, it sounds like the mistake I made with the Cape Verdean grog, which I can now confirm is finally finished. Lovely. So welcome to the County House Bar, which is a bank themed bar. All the old vaults of the Lloyd's Banker are now drinking areas in the bar, and they've left all the old vault doors there. So to your right, you can see a big heavy vault door with all of its cogs and wheels exposed. It's all very, very cool. And you've just finished the heist. How did you find it?
Very good.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
I did enjoy that.
Thank you.
But I think, although I thought the audio visuals that you provided were excellent, I think I could have solved it quicker had I been in the room and actually been able to see things and touch things.
I think so too. It was fascinating watching you guys go through that because there were certain elements of the room that had huge problems in physical play. That safe, we binned it in the end. I changed that puzzle completely because teams could not do it reliably. Mm. And because it was a real safe, I couldn't help them. I could give them the code, basically, using Frank. I didn't really use Frank much in this. I got hundreds of Frank prompts. So generally speaking, in the actual room, Frank would be your helper, not the GM. I could phone the team on the telephone and like call myself the ever-safe technical support guy, which I sometimes did. So I could contact them, but generally I used Frank whispering through the air vents. But yes, so certain elements you found much easier. Once you had the numbers of the safe is done. Whereas for some teams, in reality, having the numbers was the easy part, and the safe, following the instructions for the safe, were impossible. For various reasons, a lot of the time it was because people just can't follow instructions.
Hmm.
They'd turn the dial and they'd overshoot, and they'd think they hadn't, and they'd try and go back.
But then you got to reset.
Then they get frustrated, then their mate would try and do it. Or they'd get one number wrong. And I had various ways of helping them. And on some teams, there'd be someone who was good at it and could just basically tell everyone else to fuck off and let them do it, and would just slowly, methodically work through the instructions and get on with it. But if a team didn't have that person and struggled, they'd be in real trouble. And unfortunately, the safe also, because it was a real safe, wasn't good at telling you what you had done wrong. Mm. I could probably tell you, because I had a camera just above it that looked down on the dial, I could probably tell you using Frank, but even then, will you get it right, or will you make a different mistake next time? So in the end, the safe went bye-bye, which was a shame, because safe in a bank, right? But you guys sailed through that. And I was very pleased, Aled, when you put together the newspaper clipping.
Yeah, that was amazing.
And you guys had already found some of the numbers in the High Street photograph. You put those two pieces of information together, along with the hints for third second in the safe instructions. That all functioned exactly as I always envisioned that it would. But in reality, when the physical room existed, teams often struggle to make that leap. I wonder if the reason is that we three of us have all of this stuff just in front of us.
Mm.
Whereas back then, those other prompts were on the other wall, not the one with the safe on it. Now, the room is less than 2 meters wide, so this stuff is not far away. But because it's just geolocated slightly differently, people made assumptions about what it was for.
Yeah.
For example, the numbers inside the newspaper clipping, people kept trying to use them on the keypad because it happened to be near to the keypad. Now, thematically, it has nothing to do with the keypad. They look totally different. But because they were geographically kind of near each other, people just went, okay, that must be to do with that. Why? So yeah, that was a struggle with people, whereas you guys found that very easy.
Because we could analyze everything.
You say we guys, I mean, I'm going to give that one to Aled completely, because you made that leap so quickly.
That one does go to Aled, but you had your own times to shine on a coast. You put together the logic behind the fishing puzzle.
Yeah, I very quickly, get that.
Which is that it wasn't what was there, it was what was missing. Mm-hmm. In the original version of this puzzle, it was the items of equipment that were available until somebody, and I think it was Team Squared actually, when they came to test it, one of their criticisms was that that puzzle didn't actually make sense, because if he's gone fishing, surely he's taken the
stuff. That's what he would have taken, yeah.
So exactly. Mm-hmm. So we then changed it. So the items there are the ones that are not the answer. And the items missing tell you what he was fishing for. And that brings us to the annoying phone message. So the reason the phone message is so long and so annoying is to prevent you from brute forcing it.
Mm.
Ah.
Because if you've only got 30 fish, if you can just keep punching in answers or keep saying answers, it's not going to take you long to just try them all.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have to wait like a minute every time, and this is without dialing on the phone, which is had a little rotary dialer on it. So even to dial zero, it took a little while. That whole process, I think it took about 45 seconds to try each combination, which meant if you started at the top left, you would spend 20 minutes trying to brute force this thing before you
get it
right.
And let's be fair, I would try and brute force it.
You would. So, and you could, but you'd have a team member wasting 20 minutes doing it when you could just work it out. Did anything stand out to you guys as unfair?
I'm not sure how I feel about the fact that 3 out of 4 gemstones were actual physical gemstones, and the fourth was an image of a gemstone.
Mm. Yes, so there were 4 gemstones in the original version of the game, including a real ruby.
Oh, wow.
We used a lab-grown ruby, which is relatively cheap, actually, and they were all real gemstones, and you had to measure them. And you got them in various places. The reasoning for putting the red one on the mug was kind of twofold. So I wanted that puzzle to have an extra leap in it, a leap of understanding. And there already was one, but unfortunately for you guys, it was instant. You knew the order of the gems because it's in the logo of the company, right? Most teams did not realize that was the order of the gems. even though there's a big screen in front of them and that logo is everywhere, because they've already seen it a few times at that point, they sort of discount it. It's very strange. I'd had teams staring at the TV screen going, what is the order? What is the order? And then one of them would have an awful moment of realization and then scream, because the order is literally on the screen in front of them, incorporated into the company logo. Whereas for you guys, because it was just, you know, on your screen in front of you with everything else, it was the only order that was.
So, yeah, we had the benefit of not having the room being the distraction.
Mm. Yeah.
But you also had the... You also had the disadvantage of the room not giving things order. Yeah. So you ended up with just a bunch of stuff that you had to sift through and try and figure out what was relevant. Whereas in an actual physical room, you could look at things individually.
I was going to say, because the one time that I did the escape room in actual real life, I was just going back and forth and just touching everything and just like fiddling with things to see what could come out.
It's a physical experience.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's where... Although I think, you know, all the audiovisual clues that you provided were excellent. Because there's the added kinesthetic element to it when you're physically in the room. I think I might have gotten certain places quicker. But then again, maybe I wouldn't have, you know, maybe we wouldn't have made the leaps that Alla did. And with the gemstones, we might not have got that.
You lose and you gain. When there's physical stuff, you lose and you gain. For example, the bars puzzle at the beginning, I don't think I successfully created the image of what was in front of you, to be honest. I had to kind of steer you through it. And I think that was my fault. I think I didn't accurately describe what was happening enough. Whereas, of course, if you see the laser passing through the individual bars and then stopping, you start to fiddle around with the bar where it stops and you realize, oh, I can turn this thing. Oh, there's a hole in it.
Yeah.
Where the laser goes, oh, I see what you do.
Because I think I thought that the laser was running perpendicular to the bars, not through the bars.
Yes. It took me a while to realize that was the misunderstanding, but I kind of clocked it and then spoon-fed that a bit more, and it was fine. But watching a team do that physically, they had a whole other problem, because what they would do is shine the torch at the thing they were looking at, which made the laser disappear.
Yeah.
You had to look at it in the dark, but if we didn't give them a torch, they couldn't look at anything. So you had this awful quandary where if a team used the torch too little, they couldn't find anything. If they used it too much, they managed to make their own puzzle invisible.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's the other
thing. Which was a bit of a problem.
To be actually physically in the dark.
So it was never totally dark. When the kind of quote-unquote power goes off, the screens, which really did dominate the room, they were black, but they weren't off.
Yeah.
So there was always a slightly pale glow in the room, which actually was lovely. It was very very effective. And you guys didn't get to really
experience it.
Really experience that. The other thing you didn't get to really experience is that at the end of the room, when I said like things explode, now obviously we couldn't have all of that stuff exploding, but we did have some pyrotechnics.
Oh, nice.
So at the end of the game, when you overloaded the generator, there'd be this like... We had surround sound, full 5.1. So we had like this rumbling sound, kind of alarms coming out of that end of the room to help people, to make them move away. And then a cold spark machine was buried above the shutter. So suddenly showers of sparks would rain down from the ceiling around the shutter. And then it would raise.
Nice.
It was very cool. Very cool. And people always loved the ending, because it was, you know, you want to keep your finale and where you're spending the money to the end, right? And it was a great ending.
I was going to say, so you say it is no more.
Yes.
Has a different escape room taken its place, or is it just no more?
It's closed. They've both closed. The bank job and the heist. Basically, it wasn't making enough money. The venue runs a pretty successful bar too, and could use the spaces as drinking spaces or storage spaces as well. And if the escape room is only making, you know, a few hundred quid of profit each month, and the bar's making thousands.
Yeah, it just makes sense.
Eventually.
Yeah.
It made sense to just can it. They were both good rooms. They were both unusual rooms because they were designed and built very differently to normal escape rooms. It's quite hard to do it credit, but both of them had the advantages that they felt very solid. Mm. Like when I say those bars were solid, you weren't getting out unless I let you out. All of the Madlocks we used were security grade. Everything was very heavy and felt very real. And we had a huge desire to make that reality, because escape rooms can be guilty of being a bit paper thin at times. And all of us who were designing it and Steve, who was building it, all of us didn't want that. And we're kind of unified in that. So the gemstones were all real gemstones, you know, cheap ones, but actual gemstones. They weren't plastic, so that when you held them in your hand, they felt like the real thing. And the safe was real, which caused its own problems, but it, you know, you felt like you were handling a real safe.
Just out of curiosity.
So we always love that stuff.
Because obviously I happen to recognize Frank, probably from an FBI Most Wanted poster, but I happen to recognize him. I did wonder, does he make an appearance in the manager one as the bank manager?
So the bank manager, Mr. Sterling's picture on the wall, the man with the beard.
Oh, okay. So
he is actually Dan Kelsall, who is the owner of the venue.
Oh, really?
He's a lovely, lovely man, and was is still the venue owner, and was my boss at this time. He's a good egg. So he got to be the bank manager, and Frank, yes, was played by the venerable Andrew Cullum, who did a wonderful job both voicing and then being Frank. And we had a shoot day with real guns. We hired an armorer who was mad.
As they naturally would be.
Very odd niche, that. We hired an armorer. He brought real weapons. I had to be like both the COVID officer and the firearm safety. I had to give the firearm safety briefing. And the firearm safety briefing went like this. Gentlemen, ladies, under no circumstances are any of you to take any of the guns outside of the building. The building's locked. It looks like a bank. And the guns are real. Disabled, but real. Yikes. So all it takes is a phone call from someone seeing someone with a gun
outside of a
bank. And we've got the SWAT team on the premises. So please, no guns outside of the building.
My fear, if I ever were to work with guns anywhere, my fear would always be, are they properly disabled?
Alec Baldwin.
Exactly. Yeah. Like Alec Baldwin, is it Brandon Lee?
Yeah.
There's been a few
where I'm just like, that just like, why are there even bullets anywhere near this? If it's just a prop, why can it not be a proper prop?
The thing is, you can do a lot with just props. And none of these guns worked. But if you cast your mind back to the video where one of the robbers shoots the other guy, there's a muzzle flash. There's a bit of recoil. There's a blood splatter. Yep. All credit to Nathan Lee there, who was our marketing man and did the video editing and directed the shoot. I was assisting him and being one of the performers in it. And he was directing. And we used the real CCTV feed of the building. So all of the camera feeds with the CCTV on it are actual CCTV feeds. And he added in the muzzle flash and the blood splash and all of that. All of that was put in post.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, well done. Wow. Yeah.
Good job. Really good job. It looks
it does. Solid.
The other performers were all mates of the venue. And the most amazing thing happened. So me and Nathan were campaigning for professional actors to be hired for this. I was going to be in it. There's a young woman in the robbery at the beginning. In fact, at one point in the first video, I grab her by the hair and point a gun at her head to tell them to open one of the doors. So she was an actress. Everyone else was an amateur, including the other robbers who did most of the...
They did well.
But they did great. And the most amazing thing happens to some people. Because me and Nathan were really worried about this, like using amateurs to do anything dramatic. Like that can just go so wrong. And these guys were like builders. The guy who brought in all the heavy drills,
yeah,
his drills. He does core drilling. That's real stuff. He and the other chap who ends up in the vault with their balaclavas on, he's a builder. So they're not performers. But you put balaclavas on them, put them in a bank, give them some guns, and tell them they're robbers today. And because it's on CCTV, there's no cameras in their face, there's no sound guy with a big boom mic taking away their sense of reality. You stick them in a bank vault with a bunch of money, and we use the vault for the original bank job escape room. So everything around them looked real. They had a big vault door that really closed on them and locked them in. They had big chunks of cash and duffel bags to put them in. bars everywhere. There's actually a diamond in a cabinet in a corner in that shot from the original escape room. So you give people all the stuff to let their imagination run, and they'll run with it. And they were brilliant. They were absolutely fantastic performers. And me and Nathan were just watching the feeds as we were filming and giving a bit of direction, and we couldn't believe our luck. Because they did a fantastic job. We did have one problem, though. You heard in the footage audio of them arguing. We didn't have any. All of the audio was reconstructed by me and Nathan and dubbed in over the top.
CCTV doesn't have audio normally.
CCTV does not have audio. So we had mics for the main robbery at the beginning, and then for the stuff in the vault, me and Nathan dubbed it afterwards.
I think it worked. Well, exactly. I mean, that's all we could hear.
Yeah. Oh, what have I done? Which is a lot of fun. But there we go. That was how it was created.
That was great fun.
Yeah. It was a good room.
It's fun to see behind the curtain a little bit.
Yeah. What you didn't see was the janky piece of software that ran the whole thing. So all of the videos were all on a piece of software that was written for the purpose.
I try not to see software anyway. I wouldn't know the difference between software and hardware if they came up and bopped me on the head.
You would.
I really wouldn't.
By definition, you would.
Software wouldn't bop you. Hardware would.
I see. Okay.
But yeah, it could have lived.
It must have been good, but it's over now.
Pretty much. You know, I was just trying to think about why.
Well, if it's financially motivated, then...
Financially motivated, yeah.
Capitalism.
Yeah, basically.
One must always be growing rather than just enjoying where one is.
Yes, God, yes. That's pretty much it. You've got the rub there, Anikos. Still, it was a lot of fun to bring it back to life.
Well, thank you for bringing us in on it.
Yeah, that was really good.
Its final outing.
No, my pleasure. I will never produce anything as high quality.
I was just going to say, you realize that you've now set yourself an unrealistically high bar.
You've peaked, John. That's it. It's all downhill from here.
Like software and a film shoot
and recorded.
And a load of recorded audio. Yeah, yeah. But it does make you think, though. There must be dozens and dozens of ex escape rooms now that no longer exist. That you could do that with. You could recreate them as best you could. So it wasn't a perfect recreation. There were a few things that had to be changed, a couple of puzzles that I just abandoned completely. So you were doing, it wasn't exactly a simplified version. You were doing an earlier version than the final version of the room that we ended up with. So you had some of the really hard stuff in that got changed, not necessarily for easier things, but for a wider dispersal of things. So it was a bit more multilinear by the time I left. Because it turns out that running an escape room is a terrible combination with an acting career. I say career in the loosest possible sense. All takes place at weekends. Yeah. Madness. Madness, madness, madness. But yeah, there must be dozens of escape rooms out there that could be recreated in audio format.
It's a bit like I used to do workshops, sort of themed workshops for a theatre company. And they used to be quite big, and they did maths workshops and restorative approaches, you know, sort of PSHE workshops, that kind of thing. And some of them were really good, but the company decided to downsize, anti-capitalism. And now I'm like, oh, but what happens with those workshops? Could I just run them on my
material? Own? Yeah. You'd get sued.
I would. I probably would. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I wouldn't. But sometimes I'm like, oh, I'd like to ask whether that's something that I could resurrect.
You could probably buy it off them. I imagine capitalism again. Like, I imagine if they own it and they're not using it, not making any money out of it, if you came along and said, look, I used to do those things for you. I thought it was good. I want to keep doing that product. And you don't. Can I buy it off you? They might. They probably want a silly... A silly figure.
Possibly. But, well, either silly figure or they'd want a percentage of any workshops that I ran.
Yeah, might be worth it.
Then again, if I charged what they used to charge for it, I would still get paid about 10 times as much as I used to get paid. and be able to give
this is it
cut.
And this is, and you've actually circled back beautifully to part of the problem. The problem, the sort of part of the reason that I left was A, it clashed with acting stuff a lot, but B, it just wasn't really worth my time. I wasn't on minimum wage, but I wasn't far off it. And I was running both rooms and running the booking system and dealing with customer inquiries and editing the photos. And there was, yeah, it developed into something that took up enough brain space for a light salaried job, but without the light salary, and just wasn't financially worth it for me, and couldn't really be financially worth it for me because it wasn't my business.
It wasn't your business, and also you were at a different phase in life. Like, if you were in your early 20s and you were doing it, then it would have been fine.
Yeah.
But you're not. You are a dad, you have a mortgage, you have a Tesla, you know, it's all of these things.
Every damn episode has to come up at some point.
Hey, it's a nice car.
It is a nice car. It's a very nice car. But you do make a good point. Mike has a theory about escape rooms that the reason they pop up, they tend to pop up and last in relatively deprived areas, is because you have a population of young people around there who are bright as a button, but don't have many opportunities. So you can afford to pay them not that much and get a lot out of them, not in an exploitative way, but because that's all you can afford to pay them, and you need good people. Yep. So that means like 22-year-olds who are like into puzzles and stuff, but still live at home and can thus afford to work basically for minimum wage and be fine enough with it for a while.
Or, you know, young actors who are not working as actors full time.
Or not so young
need
actors.
A day job. Hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Hmm.
Well, that's where the system falls down with not so young actors.
Hmm.
Especially once they've procreated. It's just not the same.
Yeah, God. It is not the same. It's not the same. Don't do it, Alec. Don't procreate. It's a terrible idea.
No plans.
Fair enough. Have you guys got any recommendations for the listeners? Anything you have read or listened to recently that you thought was gosh darn good?
Audiobook.
If you like.
Never Split the Difference by Chris Voss.
Chris Voss.
Yes.
Yes. I read this book.
It's exceptional. It is a book on negotiation tactics written by an ex-FBI negotiator.
Oh.
Who has now branched out and has started his own consultancy company teaching people the art of negotiation.
And it's kind of a slightly sort of corporate help manual, but it's also about life. And every chapter begins with a hostage situation.
Yikes.
Pretty much.
Yikes.
And he then broadens it out into a discussion about negotiation more widely. I love this book.
This is my favorite audiobook.
So can I ask you then, Jonathan, if you love this book and it's all about negotiating, how come you haven't like come back into the invoices and contracts team and said, hey, let me tell you about negotiating? Or is this more, you use this negotiation more with your daughter than you do sort of in business situations?
You can use it with your children. There's various things in it. And it's not sort of cynical stuff. It's about human nature. Mm. So for example, he has a whole section about the word no and the amount of power that people feel when they get to say it. And if you can get them into a position where they say it, then after they've said it, they'll be much closer to being able to say yes to you. So for example, if you're a salesperson and you're cold calling people, really hard to keep them on the line. One way to help is rather than when they pick up the phone saying or asking, like, can I have a quick word or just need 2 minutes of your time or what that, ask instead, is it a bad time?
Mm.
Because instinctively they'll say no.
Oh, really?
And they'll say no because it helps them take control or feel like they're taking control. But by saying no, they're giving you permission to speak.
Because I'm instant, like, and for me, if you're calling me, absolutely it's a bad time. Who are you? What the? No, but that might just be me.
Sure. And yeah, no, nothing works 100% of the time.
Yeah.
But I don't know much about the world of sales, but I imagine, you know, if something works 10% of the time rather than 5% of the time, then you're calling
it. Yeah, it's a numbers game, isn't it?
Yeah, huge numbers game. There's small things like that. And one of his big rules, if I recall, is never antagonize your counterpart.
That's a last resort.
The person you're negotiating with. Yeah. And he includes, like, I don't care if they've got your mother, at the point of a gun. I don't care if they're an absolute monster. Your job as a negotiator is to empathize with this person. Mm. They might be doing terrible things that you find abominable, but there is a reason they're doing them. In their head, there's a good reason they're doing them, and you need to be able to understand that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I totally back that recommendation, Elliot. That's a great book. Really good. Anikos?
I don't read good books these days because my brain just can't handle them. But I'll tell you a book that I really enjoyed, which I picked up from one of those like community libraries. You know, it's literally a box outside somebody's house. And it's called A Lady's Guide to Scandal.
What?
Is it called? There's that Scandal Making? Scandal Making? Scandal Mongering? A Lady's Guide to Scandal. And it's a...
Sounds wonderful.
It's a romance novel written by a lady who was really into the Regency period and has done extensive research into the Regency period and read, you know, all the Jane Austens and not just Jane Austen, but also all the Georgette Heyer, which if you're into Regency sort of style romance, that's a really great one to read. Apparently she wrote a dissertation or she wrote a paper on how Georgette Heyer helped to win the war, which I now want to read. But basically, it's a Regency romp, but it's, I don't know, it was just really fun and light and enjoyable and clever and believable, but also with sort of modern sensibilities. So I really enjoyed that. And
so could I just ask, is it contemporaneous to the period or is it written in the modern day?
Oh, no, it's written in the modern day. So,
okay.
And she's written one book before, which I think is called A Lady's Guide to Fortune Hunting, which, given that I'd never heard of this writer and never heard of this book, what is it? A Lady's Guide to Scandal? I think it's just Scandal. Maybe it's Scandal Making. Scandal Mongering? Anyway.
And it's Georgette Heyer?
No, it's not Georgette Heyer. So the writer is called Sophie Irwin. And I read in the introduction to the book that she always loved the Georgette Heyer books, which I do too. I've read probably all of them and quite a few of them several times over. Just because I'm the kind of person, if I enjoy a book, then I will read it again. I'm not one of those people who reads a book once and then is like, okay, great, I've read that and now I'm done.
I'm the opposite, generally.
Yeah, I find that interesting.
Not all the time, but generally I'm one and done with books and films.
No. It's mainly sort of with really comforting books, although there are some uncomfortable books that I've read more than once. So I've read Snow Falling on Cedars more than once. I've read Beloved by Toni Morrison more than once, which are not comfortable sort of forget about the world books, I would say. Especially if it's a comfortable book or, you know, it just, it's a sort of switch off.
People are.
In the same way that, you know, a lot of people are rewatching Friends because it's comforting to watch because you already know what's going to happen and it's, you know, that there's going to be a happy ending. The Georgette Heyer Regency novels, generally speaking, you can be guaranteed that it's going to have a happy ending. Even though you can, you know, afterward, once you've finished reading it, you can go, I mean, how happy is that really going to be? And, you know, with the Moors of the time, isn't the Duke going to, you know, have several mistresses and visit prostitutes and all that kind of stuff, even though he's married to who he proclaims is the love of his life? But, you know, you try not to have those kind of qualms about it.
Fair enough. Whenever she's sick, my wife, Sinead, wants to watch Anne of Green Gables.
Yes.
That's like her comfort TV, if you can find it, because it's ancient now. But
she'll sit there and
watch Anne of Green Gables.
Anne with an E?
I don't think so, no.
On Netflix? Oh, I thought it was good. But if she's a purist, she may not enjoy it, because what the new series does is... rather than it being this sort of utopian kind of Victorian, Edwardian idyll. I mean, I say that there's lots of death that happens as well around Anne, but they go into some more of the sort of actual problems of the time. So there's the, I think in season 3, she meets a girl from the native, one of the sort of native Canadian tribes. Mm-hmm. And then it goes on to show how the white people treated the original.
Did they give them presents?
They didn't give them presents. I mean, I'm sure they did as well. But at that time, what they did was they basically abducted the children. They found a quasi-legal way to abduct the children, and they locked the children up in schools and did horrible things like cut the boys' hair off, which like they would only, I think that tribe, according to this, to the storytelling in the series, boys from that tribe would only ever cut their hair when they were mourning something or someone. So they cut their hair off. They wouldn't allow them to use their own language. They had to use English. They had to pray, obviously, you know, to the correct God.
To the good Lord.
Yeah. So they indoctrinated the children horrifically, you know, and locked them up and beat them and starved them and did all kinds of horrendous things to them. Because, you know, if you start with the children then and you indoctrinate them young enough, then they will, then when they have children, they will pass those things on to their children. So
it's kind of the standard colonial playbook.
Yeah, it's very much the standard colonial playbook. So it's interesting that...
I don't want to minimize the horror.
No.
Because it is, but you could look at that in, even closer to home, you could look at that in the English treatment of the
Absolutely.
Irish.
Absolutely.
During the 800 years of repression.
And Welsh.
Yep.
And Welsh. Yeah, the Welsh had it coming.
Punch him in the face, Alad.
But yeah, you can find that pattern.
I mean, the Romans did it as well, didn't they? So
the Romans did it. Like any culture that is able to militarily dominate another, how do you then turn that into cultural hegemony?
Yep.
You do that through indoctrinating and changing the language and changing what they're taught. I mean, look at Russia and Ukraine. Yeah. Like, look at what's happening with schools in the occupied territories there. It worked 2,000 years ago in ancient Rome, and it is the way conquering powers do that now.
So, so it's interesting because in the books, there is never any mention of...
I bet no.
I don't think commentary. There's even any mention of any non-white people, let alone any mention of, you know, the original inhabitants of the land. So it's interesting that they've modernized it and... There's a lesbian relationship in it as well. So it still has the charm. And I think it's very well cast and very well played. So it still has the original charm, but it does also bring along criticism of the age and of the Moors of the time.
That might upset the purists.
That's what I'm saying. So I don't know whether Sinead would be upset by it or whether she would appreciate. So maybe not when she's ill.
It sounds like a pretty healthy evolution, though.
Absolutely.
Because if you're going to make something again, you're not just doing it so you can reshoot it on better cameras.
It's like what Greta Gerwig did with Little Women, in a sense, because I've always loved Little Women. Again, a book that I've reread several times, and I loved the 1990s film with Winona Ryder and Christian Bale as Laurie.
Oh wow!
But what Greta Gerwig did really cleverly was again sort of put it in more of a wider context of its time. So it's not just the idyll. She doesn't give... Oh, spoiler alert, but she doesn't give Joe a happy ending, which she does in the book. Louisa May Alcott gives her a happy ending in the book. But apparently, when she initially wrote Little Women, she didn't give her main character, who's based somewhat on herself, a happy ending because she didn't have the traditional happy ending.
To change
she didn't, you know, run off with the professor and have a happy life with him in a, you know, busy household full of wayward children. But her publisher made her change it because he was like, well, women only want, you know, the Little Women readers, they only want a happy ending.
So she did. Have you heard of the original ending of The Little Mermaid?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Ooh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I have the
Hans Christian Andersen.
I have a bundle of Hans Christian Andersen tales, and We know in the Netherlands, we know a number of his tales, not just the Little Mermaid. So there's also a tale about
you guys are better at dark, keeping dark stories alive.
Though. Yeah.
We've sanitized a lot of stuff.
Yeah, she ends up with a broken heart and turns into sea foam, but also when she takes the potion
and goes to God.
Sorry?
Well, the original one, she like ascends to heaven.
Oh no, he is very religious. So like the little match girl also, there's something about how she doesn't pray to God enough or something, and that's why she dies. But the Little Mermaid as well, when she gets her legs, not only is her voice taken away from her, but also her feet bleed with every step as if she is walking either broken shells or glass, broken glass.
Yeah. So she can dance, but it's
absolute agony. Yeah. Did he also write The Red Shoes, or was that a different folktale?
That's such a Red Shoes detail, isn't it? The walking, but it's agony, or dancing, but it's agony. Yeah. I wonder. I don't know. Oh, cool. So I'm just thinking of my own recommendation now. I have just gone back to the fantasy genre for the first time in a long time, and I'm reading A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin.
Okay.
I'd never read any Ursula Le Guin or really heard of her, but she was being discussed on the radio, and Sinead and I were listening to it, and Sinead, being rather brilliant in this way, noted my interest, and then next time my birthday came round, there was a thick volume of Ursula K. Le Guin in some paper, and it's wonderful. It's really wonderful. I always feel a bit fearful with fantasy. Now I'm grown, because I loved it so much as a child and teenager, and I worry that if I revisit it,
the magic's gone.
The magic, not only is the magic gone, but that I'll have destroyed that
memory.
That memory. Like I loved, when I was like 14, 15, I loved the His Dark Materials series, The Northern Lights, The Southern Life, and The Amber Spyglass, and found them gripping and then ultimately heartbreaking books. And I don't dare read them again. So Wizard of Earthsea, it's the first book in this big tome of, I think, four or five books in this world called Earthsea. And it's wonderful. She's got an incredibly specific style, and it's really hard to pin down. It's almost like her words sort of flow out in a very ethereal way, but also with an almost biblical authority. You truly believe that she is speaking of a land that is old and detailed, and has all of these little like stories and ancient tales and myths and time before those myths in it, and has a variety of peoples in it that have their own traditions and their own expectations of each other and their own little foibles and strangeness and idiosyncrasies. And it's all, she doesn't hit you over the head with it. You follow this kid, Ged, and you know what he sees, you see, more or less. But you get a wonderful sense of a wider world to it, which I'm sure I'm going to get to explore. But yeah, it's been wonderful so far. I'm only 60 pages in, but it's already got me firmly gripped. So yes, A Wizard of Earthsea by Ursula K. Le Guin. That is my recommendation.
Nice.
And with that, at 11:38 p.m. I think we'll call it a night.
I think that's a good idea.
Thank you very much for joining me, guys. Thank you, dear listener, for joining us. And we will see you next week on the Infinite Escape Room.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.